Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumbo Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumbo Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumbo Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Well, thank you very much, Audrey, for getting us online one more time and making the show go off live. Can we ask a question here to get started? Audrey, would you punch Mike over there when you have time and ask him, drinking that Scandal's Best Coffee, he won't stop, and ask him why we keep getting Java intrusion while we're trying to broadcast the show, or at least get set up for the show. Is Java part of the CIA or what? I can't believe it, but I keep turning off Java and it keeps coming back. What a resistance it really has. But anyway, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Network and the Jumbo Justice Radio Show. I'm your host, Keith Haley, and we want to thank Johnny Cash, as we do every week, for taking us on that marvelous trip across 90 cities and states in the United States. And what a wonderful song. He sings that. Some other people sing that song, too. Maybe we'll play a few of those. One of the Texas boys sings that for sure, but we might have somebody else play that if Johnny wouldn't get mad. Some night. Emily and Mike, thank you very much for joining us soon again for all the background work you do in getting us ready with the news and the technical aspects of the show. What we're trying to do here is discuss news, issues, and events and developments in this always difficult and sometimes humorous practice of criminal justice. You know, I sort of get in a rut while I'm in one. We're going to do another book review tonight, and it's a book that you know I've been reading because occasionally I talk about it, and it's Three Felonies a Day with Harvey Silverglade. And he presented this to a group on Book TV. And, of course, I keep recommending, or I have at least for several weeks, take a look at Book TV online, and you can see the video presentation anywhere from an hour to over 2 hours of these authors presenting their works going back as recently as this month and as far back as a number of years. So I think next week we might actually listen to Michelle Malkin talk in-depth. There's also an in-depth section for C-SPAN Book TV. That's C-SPAN. And Brian Lamb, I've actually spent part of an evening with him one time, and he is a marvelous person, and, of course, the whole C-SPAN network was his idea, or at least he ran it and built the thing. So our show is dedicated to those law enforcement, courts, and corrections, and juvenile justice professionals who protect us throughout the world and right here in the United States at all levels, federal, state, local, township, block, whatever you want. These people are busy keeping us safe. And we should commend them, and we really should, because we have the lowest crime rates we've had over the last 2 or 3 years in about a half century. And that's something to brag about. And they're going through some hard times now. Talked to one of my friends who's a an administrator in the justice system. I won't call out where it is because that might be a little bit embarrassing, but he had made substantial cuts in his budget according to what they asked for, and they just came back and asked for a couple $100,000 more. So it's going to be a dark week for people when they get the news about something here this week about what they'll probably have to do. But anyway, how short can we have these criminal justice officials run? Fortunately, that's not happening that prevalent. At least I don't think it is across the United States in terms of cutbacks of personnel. There are other things they're doing in terms of certain kinds of call for service and policing, and courts are having a little extended hours and things like that. But it doesn't seem to be as bad. At least the news I'm getting says that. But anyway, we hope it. We hope, pray that things work out for those folks and they don't lose their job. You're listening on the Blog Talk Radio Network. You could have your show by 9:15 if you wanted to sign up for your own show. We want to thank Alan Levy for that. We're up to over 180 shows. Is it 1,800? No, it's only 180, 180-some shows. And Alan Levy is the CEO of BTR, Blog Talk Radio Network, and he is what I like to say, the genius behind the medium. He put the show together, this idea together, several years ago, one show, over 3 years ago, and now it's over 30,000 different shows. And I haven't gone back to count. That number's probably old. It keeps growing. And even the President of the United States, Barack Obama, has discovered Blog Talk Radio and uses it. So what's possible? You, any interest group, any organization, you can have your own show. It can be about turtles. It can be about kayaking. It can be about firearms, tiddlywinks, whatever you want it to be. And it's absolutely free. You can broadcast worldwide to an unlimited number of listeners. And who knows how many. I think there are people that have shows every day. And it's absolutely free. It doesn't cost you one thing. 1 cent. Imagine that, just compared to what this would have been two decades ago. We have college radio stations do a lot of business because they can't afford it. Now they could be broadcasting on Blog Talk Radio at least a substantial portion of the day. These shows are archived almost immediately, something like 10 or 15 minutes later, I think. At least it used to be. And you could download those in MP3 format. You can listen on the net again to a show, or you can download it and use it as you like. There's no copyright infringement whatsoever in terms of your using these shows. And some folks do use them for various things across the United States. There's a topic on blogs. There's probably 1,000 things you're interested in, so just go look at Blog Talk Radio. I really encourage you to do that if you've not, and browse around on the different subjects. They run from, you've heard me say, laughter yoga to the most serious consulting and business and management and everything imaginable. Tonight, I mentioned we're going to look at Harvey Silverglade's book, Three Felonies a Day. Remember sort of the theme of that book? It's the idea behind the book is that if you're working in business or somewhere and you go to work in the morning and work hard all day and you come back and call it a day and try to relax in the evening, you've probably already committed three felonies. According to the federal laws, and you'll hear him talk about it, and there are literally several thousand federal laws, and they keep going. I mean, there are other people that are writing about this now, how the federal expansion of law keeps going, and they're vague. They're not specific enough for somebody even to know that they're committing a crime, but people are still getting charged with it, and I think that's something that needs to be curtailed. Unfortunately, I hear some people in Congress are interested in doing something about it. Well, you're listening on your computer probably, but you can listen on the cell phone. You can do all kinds of ways. If you happen to want to call in during our new segment, folks haven't for a long time, but we can hold five calls at a time. And when we've had group guests, you've heard we've done that, and people can hang up, and then somebody else can call. Well, we always start out with a blonde joke, and Audrey has one for tonight. And Audrey, what's this one about? Okay, yes, it's graduation exam time. Let's go ahead and hear that one. This is about somebody taking exams, right? I think it's a blonde. Go ahead.
Professor Haley, I think we have had this blonde joke on the show before, but since it is final exam and graduation time in colleges and universities all over the nation, I thought this one about taking exams would be fun. Here it is. A blonde reports for her university final exam, which consists of mainly true and false questions. She takes her seat in the examination hall, stares at the question paper for 5 minutes, and then in a fit of inspiration takes her purse out, removes a coin and starts tossing the coin, and marking the answer sheet true for heads and false for tails. Within 30 minutes she is all done, whereas the rest of the class is still working furiously. During the last few minutes, she is seen desperately throwing the coin, swearing, and sweating. The moderator, alarmed, approaches her and asks what is happening. "I finished the exam in a half hour," she replies. "Now I'm rechecking my answers."
Yeah, that could be shrieking, could it? You're not coming up with the same side of the coin. All right. Thank you very much, Audrey. And ladies and gentlemen, as we always do, the Ohio Gun Coalition, is interested in criminals turning in their weapons. And we want to play their public service announcement tonight, as we do on every show, in hopes that some criminals will hear this message, disarm themselves, take their weapons down to the police station and turn them in. And I'm sure this public service announcement directed to them has been useful over the years that we've been playing.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Well, thank you very much, Ohio Coalition. And again, we trust that that message will fall on the correct ears, the right ears, and they will take the necessary steps to disarm criminals on the streets. All right. We usually have a green tip about this time, but we've been using Esma Floyd's book, 1001 Little Ways to Save the Planet. Tonight we're going to divert from that. And okay, Mike, I'll admit it. I've been engaging in a little competitive altruism today. I bought a couple things this past weekend. And I guess I should point out, when you see me in a couple of blazers, I am wearing a Covington, a Perfect Wardrobe blazer with brass buttons. I bought two of them. One is khaki, and the other is a dark navy blue traditional blazer. And I want you to know that you can wad these blazers up. You could put them in a small plastic bag and wrap them up for about 3 hours and take them out and pop. They pop out just as straight and as smooth, like they were just ironed. But the thing I really want you to know about that is Sears now sells these things. Penny's did away with their washable suits, but they want anything like this. And this thing, it's washable, and you get a little card that comes with it. I almost feel like wearing the card, that I feel so good, so proud when I stand next to people who aren't wearing this type of thing. It's washable. It tumble dries with not a special bag or anything you have to put it in like you did the Penny suits. It is eco-sensitive. It is a mic, by the way, not like the coat you're wearing. It is 100% recyclable. It stretches. This is the other note on it. These are all done in circles in the little card, and it is flexible. It does expand, so if you want to stretch or you happen to grow a little bit, that will work. And then finally, the final circle is CO2 with an arrow pointing down, and it reduces your carbon footprint. Now, how much better can you do than that? And they also make suits, by the way. So you can get a dark suit, and this is Covington. It's called the Perfect Wardrobe. And I'm advertising for Sears. And again, it's a 100% recycled, eco-sensitive material. Mike, it's not like the jacket that you're wearing. I'm sorry. So if you see me standing a little bit taller when I wear those, then you'll know that I'm so proud to do my part sustaining the planet one jacket at a time. Well, let's take a look at some of the criminal justice news here. If we can get it up. Here we go. Let's see what we got. My first two news stories tonight have to do with census workers. I don't know if you've been paying attention to some of the events going on relative to the census, but they're really kind of interesting. let me give an example of a couple. Here's one.
see if our screen will come up. A lot of stuff going on the screen tonight. Hope this isn't another Java intrusion. Okay, we're looking to see if this will come up. I think it's coming up. So it looks like we'll have to put that down. Let's try this. One hole says it's loading. I'm sorry. Loading. What? It's not loading. Stay with us just one more second. Okay, Mozilla, we'll abandon you. We'll go to something else. This is a story in St. Louis about a census worker's dog who takes a bite out of a St. Louis man. Have you heard that story? Dan Zachary says he's a census worker approached him outside his South St. Louis condo on Tuesday. He thought it was odd that the worker had his dog with him. While he was answering questions, Vaco said the dog jumped up and bit him in the stomach. In fact, you can watch the video. It's on it's a Fox News video, I think, on the Internet. Remember I told you how to use Bing to get all these videos? You go to bing.com, then hit videos, and type in any subject imaginable. If you type in just news, you'll get all these little video rows, squares, of stories, and you just hold your mouth open and they start playing. You don't even have to open it. Anyway, he's not pleased, to say the least, and he wonders why the worker was allowed to leave with the dog. The animal control officer says it will monitor the dog for rabies. That's nice. And the case will be reviewed to see if the dog can remain with its owner. But isn't that something? My gosh, a census worker who's bringing a defensive dog around with him. Now, here's a second census story, something you probably wouldn't imagine. Whoops. Did I get rid of that one? I don't think so. This one is even more interesting. A New Jersey mom, the headline runs, recognizes. I don't know if I can change that. Can I do that, Mike? Okay. A New Jersey mom, let's try it this way. Yeah. She recognizes a man with U.S. Census badge knocked on Amy small box door on the May 4th, thinking that answering the door to a government worker was a real safe bet, and then she wondered why he looked so familiar. As soon as the man left her home, Schmalbach realized where she had seen him before. She'd seen him on the state sex offender registry. Can you believe that? I figured this is a government worker. I'm safe, Schmalbach says, age 33. She had given him names and birth dates of her family to the man who called himself James. The man's real name is Frank Cooney, but he goes by many aliases, including James Shepard. It was under the name Jamie Shepard that he applied for a door-to-door job with the U.S. Census Bureau. But isn't that incredible? Schmalbach verified on the sex offender registry that the man who was knocking on the door in her neighborhood was indeed the 47-year-old Cooney, who had been convicted of assaulting an underage girl and having inappropriate contact with two other victims. Can you believe that? If I'd not recognized who this person was, none of my neighbors would have. I believe he would continue to go door to door looking for who knows whatever. Well, I won't go on with the story, but you sort of get the point. Isn't that absolutely incredible? Now, ladies and gentlemen, the immigration story's been picking up, quite a bit here in the last 4 or 5 months. Illegal immigration story. I'm not afraid to use that term. The illegal immigration story. And tonight, by the way, if you have the opportunity, Governor Jan Brewer, that courageous governor who's sounding more presidential every day, of Arizona, who supports and signed that tough immigration law, illegal immigration law, and she's read it, by the way, and so have I. I've read it twice. No, I think I've read it three times, actually. And remember that our Homeland Security Director, Janet Napolitano, admitted here this week she has not read the law. And then neither has Eric Holder, who's the Attorney General of the United States, that is having his staff prepare some suits, perhaps, against this law. But anyway, guess what's going on in Arizona? I bet you couldn't guess. These migrants walk for days across the desert But the illegal immigration is on the rise in Arizona. Isn't that amazing? And they start out with this sweet story down there in Nogales. I've been in Nogales. They have the migrants walk for days through miles of mesquite scrub, running low on food and sometimes water, paying armed thug drug people as guides and dodging U.S. law enforcement officers along the way, but yet they still keep coming. The latest figures show that Arizona, which is about to put into effect the nation's toughest immigration law, is the only border state where illegal crossings are on the rise. Now, are they on the rise? Well, you have to know something about the terrain and what it looks like there, and that's one of the reasons it's on the rise. But anyway, that's a longer story. But I hope they're not trying to make a correlation between the fact that Arizona is now going to have a tough law, so now that'll make more immigrants, because that would be another argument against Arizona, a new law. But while heightened security and daunting fences in Texas and California have made Arizona a busy crossing corridor for years, it's a little more than that. Migrant smugglers now are finding new ways through the state's treacherous deserts. I almost have a tear here in my eye when I think about this. Of course, they could stay home, couldn't they? They could stay in Mexico. But I know America's the land of the free and the opportunity. But anyway, it's going to be interesting to see. But the apprehensions went down, but let's see, no, what did they say? They're up 6%. So the arrest for Arizona border was up 6%, about 10,000 from October to April of 2010. Even as apprehension of illegals dropped 9% overall. I'm still trying to work through what that means. I've read that several times, so I'll have to think more about it. But anyway, we're going to see what happens. Grupo Beta, a Mexican government-sponsored outfit that aids migrants, helped 5,279 people from January to April in the area across the border from Douglas, Arizona. I've been there, too, compared to 3,767 in the same period last year. So it looks like they're coming through. Maybe they're all trying to get into Arizona before the new crackdown actually starts. I think the law goes into effect about August. It took 90 days from when it was signed. So we'll have to see what happens. But anyway, that's what's going on in Arizona, and you're going to hear more and more about it. And if you get a chance to hear on the Greta Van Susteren's show on Fox News tonight at 10 o'clock, it'll be interesting to hear Governor Jan Brewer talk about it. Now, this Arizona law has consequences, doesn't it, for people other than illegal immigrants and the people that live in the state of Arizona? You know, the city of Los Angeles has decided to boycott Arizona. And here, Mayor Coleman in Detroit, or excuse me, I'm sorry, Columbus. Mayor Coleman in Columbus, Ohio, has decided to do the same thing. He's banned city worker travel to Arizona because of that state's new law allowing police to demand documentation from people that they suspect are in the country illegally. The mayor will not be approving any travel to Arizona. I don't know how much travel that will be, but he did, I think he turned down one city technology director who was going to attend a seminar in Phoenix. And he's going to talk to other department heads about this, and I'm sure Arizona will really feel the pinch from not receiving people from the city of Columbus that work for the city departments there. So talk about putting the pressure on Arizona. This will probably make them turn around. I wouldn't doubt it. How about this one? A TSA agent is accused of stealing. Transportation security. He must not have known about his own security devices, but this agent's been arrested for allegedly stealing about $400 from a wheelchair-bound passenger as she passed through a security checkpoint at a Newark airport. Leroy Ray allegedly went into the disabled woman's bag as it passed through the x-ray machine. You know, we've got accelerated penalties for hate crimes and that type of business. I don't know. Do we have accelerated penalties for taking things away from the disabled or harming the disabled? I would certainly hope so, but talk about that low class. Ray was caught on surveillance video on February 3rd, 2010, reaching into the woman's bag to steal an envelope full of cash, according to the criminal complaint. The 50-ish-year-old woman, investigators said, was from North Jersey, and she was flying out of Jersey to see relatives overseas. Well, the Supreme Court's been busy here recently. You've probably heard about some of those cases. We don't want to take too long tonight because we need to get to our feature speaker and book review. But the Supreme Court has now said that it's okay, some states have been doing it, California, I believe, is one of those, that you can hold a sex offender beyond his sentence now if they're considered dangerous. And the way the law looks at, I haven't read the court decision. Now, that's not exactly the same as not reading Arizona law, but I haven't read the full court decision, but the way it worked in the state of California was that if there was a preponderance of evidence, and that's what you need for a civil conviction, for example. In other words, if the scales tip just enough to say, yes, this guy's dangerous versus no, he's not dangerous, then you can hold them beyond his actual sentence for the sex crimes that he's in prison for, or for some other crime, for that matter. So that's kind of an interesting. Civil libertarians say, well, that's not fair. You know, the guy did his time. Why, in fact, are we going to hold him? I say him, but it could be a her also. But I'll bet 99.9% are him. There's another case that the Supreme Court just ruled on in the same session, and the case, I won't go over it in details, but the case has to do with sentencing juveniles to life for crimes. There's about 2,000 in the United States that are sentenced to life in prison. In other words, they were below the age of majority when they committed this crime. They were juveniles by state statute. That depends where you are. Ohio, you're an adult at 18. In Texas, you're adult at 17. I think one state, you're even adult at age 16. Don't quote me on that. But anyway, some other, there are, I forget, let me look, actually. There are, it's a 5-4 decision, so it was a close one. And I'm surprised about that. there are 129 juveniles in 11 states, including Virginia, who had not committed homicide but were serving sentences of life without parole. So isn't that incredible? 129, they didn't kill anybody, but they're serving sentences of life without parole. This particular guy got caught on a robbery, the case that they heard. He got caught in a robbery, and then he later got let out and picked up again for a home invasion. And the judge sentenced him to prison for life without parole. And this is a 5-4 decision that says you can't do that. In other words, you can send somebody, a juvenile, to life in prison for murder, but if the crime isn't murder, then life in prison without the opportunity of parole is now illegal. And it's a violation of the Eighth Amendment's cruel and unusual punishment clause. I agree with that decision. And frankly, I'm not sure the idea of even life without parole, that doesn't mean they're going to serve it, by the way. You've heard me talk about that enough. Just, you know, my best example is my friend who was murdered. The guy got life in prison, and he did 12 years. But anyway, an interesting case, and we'll have to see how this turns out. There'll probably be a couple cases that the reporters will follow up on to see what's happening. The Justice Department, remember we talked last week about New Orleans? Their police department is so bad. They've asked the United States Justice Department to come in and literally take over and redo their police department, which is something I still cannot believe a local police department of that size, magnitude, et cetera, asking for this. But the U.S. Justice Department has agreed to do it. So they're going to come in and take over the New Orleans Police Department, in essence, and get that thing, get that department back in shape, if it ever was. I think it probably was at one time. Well, isn't that interesting? Now, I want to talk to you about a couple more things. You know, last week we talked about the book, and we had the presentation by the author, Shane Harris, the book The Watchers. Well, I bought that book, The Watchers, The Rise of America's Surveillance. And when I was going out the door, Borders Bookstore had the original Sherlock Holmes stories. I've already got a book of all the stories, but these are very nice. 37 short stories and the complete novel of The Hounds of the Baskerville. All these appeared in Strand Magazine in various issues over the years. But what is absolutely fantastic about this book, well, two things. It also includes all 356 original illustrations drawn by Sidney Paget. And these drawings are just almost every page, just about every page has detailed drawings on there. And of course, this created the face and the body and the language and the stories for Sherlock Holmes, that they loved it. And this book, by the way, was $7.99. I can't even believe it. And there were more there. So if you happen to raid Borders Bookstore, be sure to pick up a copy of the original Sherlock Holmes. And they're just absolutely, you get all the works of Arthur Conan Doyle, and then you get all of these things done by Paget. By the way, they thought they contracted wrong with Paget, who was actually, they thought they were getting his brother. And then his brother served as the model for how Sherlock Holmes is portrayed. You've probably seen one or two pictures like that in your life. But anyway, let's take a look at Harvey Silverglade and his book, Three Felonies a Day. And I've already given you enough introduction about that. And bear with us here for a second till we get this thing rolling. We'll have it in a second here if Java doesn't intervene again.
Here we go. Harvey Silverglade explains how federal law has grown so large that the average white-collar worker can commit several federal crimes a day and not know it. The author says that the executive branch uses the law to gain greater control over upper middle class and wealthy professionals. The Cato Institute here in Washington is the host of this event. It's an hour and 15 minutes.
Well, good afternoon. Thank you for coming here. My name is Tony Blankley. I'm honored to be the guest moderator at this panel discussion this afternoon. I'm particularly delighted to get into this topic. It's about crime, about the abuse of the criminal process by prosecutors, by the system that's evolved over the last 30, 40, 50 years. I was a prosecutor myself in Los Angeles for 8 years in the 1970s, and even me, which is, by comparison, a more innocent time, I was shocked at the power that we had and the ease of abusing it and the system that was slowly getting out of control, so that even if you had good faith, even if you intended to be an honorable prosecutor, the very process by which you exercise discretion, the increasing ambiguity of the law, it was harder and harder for people to know what they were supposed to do as a crime. That used to be the proposition, that if you didn't know it was a crime, you know, I'll be a little florid in my language just for a couple of seconds. The criminal law used to be a series of oak trees that reached up into the sky, and you would see them and behold them and contemplate on it. And they were usually descriptions of the Ten Commandments. Don't kill, don't rape, don't steal, don't give false witnesses. Now the law is like the blades of grass in a meadow. You can't see them, you don't identify with them, and yet they have poisonous tips, and if you just innocently walk along the field, you can end up in legally poisoned, put in a cage. And you never knew that it was a crime. How can you be guilty of something if you never knew that it was a crime? And yet, increasingly, as we've criminalized what is really non-criminal activity, whether it's regulation, whether it's administration, and then we've created an impossibility, a sort of a moral impossibility to know whether you're supposed to be doing something, whether it's right or wrong. And we've got two authors today who have just written wonderful books. And on this topic, we're going to spend about 45 minutes, the speakers talking, and then have plenty of time to do some comments and questions from you folks. Let me I'm supposed to tell you not to to turn off your cell phones, please. One of the problems is the advance of technology creates all sorts of new opportunities for oppressive and ambiguous crimes. And I was thinking of the cell phone, which as we speak is being turned into a crime to use in various forms. So it's interesting how each new piece of technology creates a creative opportunity for well-intended people to encroach on our freedoms and safety, which is the argument that terrifies me, I think, the most amongst the people who want to do criminal laws. I'm always reminded of the fact that Robespierre, position of power when he managed the Reign of Terror, was as the commissioner for public safety. And safety justified executing people just based on the discretion of the commissioners, so the 12 commissioners who are for public safety. And so when we hear safety as a justification to encroach on our rights, we should see it for the seditious effect it has on our freedoms, I think. Let me now introduce our first speaker, who has just come back from testifying in Congress. And I read his book last night, and it is a tremendous book, Harvey Silverglate. He's been practicing law for more than 40 years, specializes in criminal defense, civil liberties, and academic freedom. He handles cases both in the state and the federal court. His focus is on the particular abuse of the federal law and federal prosecutors. And while I never practiced that way in that area, I know quite a number of federal prosecutors in town. I followed it, and it's important to this point. And so he's combined his legal experience and a career as a professor in civil liberties and a writer for Boston Phoenix and other places. It's a tremendous work. And well worth both listening to the professor now and reading this book. I stayed up last night and read it, and I think it's a tremendous book. So, Mr. Silverglate.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Let me do that. I was told I can go to the podium so you can get a better shot at me. First of all, thank you for the generous introduction, and I should say some of my best friends are prosecutors, too, or at least were until the book came out. I had an experience yesterday that was actually quite moving. When I went to testify for the House Subcommittee on Crime, I was getting out of my taxi in front of the Rayburn office building, and the taxi right back of mine, somebody jumps out, and it was a prosecutor from the Department of Justice who had spent some time in Boston prosecuting an absolutely absurd case. I thought it was an absurd case, my client, and the prosecutor got out of the taxi, came over to me and said, I read your book, and you were very fair in how you described the case. So that was the best compliment I've gotten about the book so far, that one of the prosecutors in the book who lost the case, I'm happy to say, so is my client, told me that he thought that I was fair to the department in that case. I'm sure that won't be true with all the cases, but it was a good start. And I'm particularly pleased to be here at Cato because it was 11 years ago that I was here with Alan Charles Kors, where we launched the Shadow University, the Betrayal of Liberty on America's Campuses. And the Shadow University, which is still in print, I'm happy to say, turned out to be a small classic. It resulted in the launch of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, which specializes in protecting free speech and academic freedom and due process on college campuses. Now, it's not a coincidence that my outline for the Shadow University and my outline for what turns out to be three felonies a day were done at about the same time, the mid-1980s. And the reason I started to focus on these two problems, the campus speech codes and harassment codes, and also the at that point, nascent, the beginning of the federal practice of prosecuting people under statutes that nobody could fairly understand, and for committing crimes that even a sophisticated lawyer would look at the conduct, look at the statute, look at the indictment, and wonder what it was that the defendant did. It was criminal. That's a very bad sign for a criminal justice system. An experienced lawyer can't tell you why it's a crime that, you know, somebody who's been indicted for conduct can't figure out why. So, but it's no coincidence, because vagueness is really the enemy of liberty. It allows deans, prosecutors, it allows them to do whatever they want to whomever they want, and as long as there's nothing to stop them, then this is just a steamroller. The speech codes on the campus and the statutes that I'm talking about are really the quintessential elements of this vagueness due process problem. Vagueness is a due process problem. If you are prosecuted for doing something where you had no reasonable notice it was a crime, that is a violation of the due process. And I'm going to just read you a couple of sentences. This is from, taking us back 11 years, this is from the Shatter University, and it's about some of the excerpts and some of the speech codes on campuses. And I'll just read you four sentences here. Sometimes the policies say it all. In New England, quote, harassment, close quote, has included within recent times jokes and ways of telling stories, quote, experienced by others as harassing. That's Bowdoin College. Quote, verbal behavior that produces feelings of impotence, anger, and disenfranchisement, whether intentional or unintentional, Brown University. Speech that causes loss of self-esteem or a vague sense of danger, Colby College, or even, quote, inappropriately directed laughter, inconsiderate jokes, and stereotyping, University of Connecticut. Anyway, I don't have to, I think, read any more for you to get the picture. You can be thrown out of college, and students are indeed thrown out of college all the time for that kind of behavior based on those kinds of codes. Of course, what it means is the dean can get rid of anybody that the dean wants to get rid of, because we all don't tell inappropriately directed humor, blah, blah, blah. So that problem came up in the mid-1980s, and as I said, on the federal criminal side, I noticed the same vagueness, the same, you know, ease with which somebody who for some reason came within a prosecutor's sight could be indicted and convicted and sentenced. And that's because judges tend far more than they should to kind of go along with it. Oh, we all understand what this means, don't we? Well, you know, no, Your Honor. Some of us don't. We actually pay attention to the English language, and we don't understand this gibberish. So by 1990, I had the book outlined. It took me all this time to get around to writing it, because I've been practicing law while I've been trying to write, and that's a bit of a burden. We lawyers don't get sabbaticals. And I have to say, I had a tremendous amount of encouragement to finish this book, because it was quite a chore. It took me almost 5 years, by Tim Lynch and by David Bowes here at Cato. They thought that it was an essential undertaking, and every time I started to lag a little, they would give me a little boost. They're terrific guests, I have to say, really practiced. And let me explain for a moment the title, Three Felonies a Day. It's slightly sarcastic, maybe slightly humorous, but the notion is this. An average busy professional in this country gets up in the morning, you know, gets the kids off to school, goes to work, uses the telephone, there we go, federal offense, uses the telephone or email, has meetings, or works on a prospectus or a bank loan or whatever, goes home, puts the kids to bed, dinner, reads the newspaper, and it goes to sleep and has no idea that in the course of that day, he or she has very likely committed three felonies that some ambitious creative prosecutor can pick out of that day's activity and put into an indictment if the Fed so wants. And that's, as I say, a slight exaggeration, but really not much. I want to also point out the phenomenon that I'm not talking about. I'm not talking about federalism. Do I personally believe the federal government has usurped areas that should remain with the states? I do, and I also think we're much better off leaving them to the states because the states actually do a better job in a lot of these kinds of criminal areas. But I'm not talking about federalism. I'm also not talking about another problem, over-criminalization, which I know that Cato is very active in dealing with right now. There's so many crimes on the books, the explosion of the criminal statutes. I think that's a huge problem. But when you at least can understand them, then you at least have a leg up, because if you can navigate a day, if you understand what the law is, you can presumably navigate a day without becoming a criminal. But when the statutes are vague, you're helpless. You're totally at the mercy of the government because nobody can figure out. Even if you wanted to be a slave, you couldn't figure out how to be a slave because you don't know what you should refrain from doing. So this is a problem separate from, although somewhat related to, the others. Now, Alan Dershowitz wrote a foreword to the book, and he was completely free, of course, rightly wanted some of his theories of how to solve this problem I actually don't agree with, and some I do, but he has a very interesting paragraph about Dershowitz litigated some cases in the old Soviet Union. And he was always taken by the fact that they could prosecute anybody they want because, you know, some of the statutes were so vague, you know, they outlawed hooliganism. And, of course, who is a hooligan? I guess depended on whether the government in power liked you or didn't like you, and that's how they determined if you were a hooligan. And he points out in the foreword that this was a technique developed by Beria, who was the infamous sidekick to Stalin, who said, quote, "Show me the man, and I'll find you the crime," close quote. And that really is something that has survived the Soviet Union, has in fact crossed continents, and has arrived here in the good old USA. "Show me the man," says any federal prosecutor, "and I can show you the crime." We are, it's not an exaggeration, ask anybody who's been indicted, ask anybody who's tried one of these crazy cases, it is not an exaggeration. It may not have hit everybody in this room yet, but it certainly can and certainly will hit a few. Now, how does this play out in the United States? Why is it that the Department does this, Department of Justice? Well, to some extent, this weapon is aimed at unpopular citizens and members of unpopular or suspicious groups. It isn't, I think, the primary impetus, but it certainly is a tool, for example, for going after these days Muslims, people in a political party out of power. Anybody who happens to be a target for any reason, they go after. But it's hardly limited to just unpopular groups. For the most part, I think these prosecutions are random. They sometimes have a lot to do with decisions of prosecutors and wanting to get their name in the papers. But and sometimes there are prosecutors with psychological disabilities that sort of, you know, they think that it's their job to clean up the world, to clean up the country, dishonest people. But, you know, fundamentally, I don't really understand all of the motives that go into the use of these weapons. I only can tell you, I mean, I'm not a sociologist, I'm not a psychiatrist or a psychologist. I can just tell you that these weapons are sprung with alarming frequency and increasing frequency. And, you know, you can assess the motives of the people who spring them. Let me make a prediction. My prediction is that we are going to be seeing in the next couple of years a tidal wave of prosecutions growing out of the financial crisis. Different people from different perspectives have different explanations for why we had a crash. But the Department of Justice is going to have figured it out. If fraudulent individuals have causalism. It's got nothing to do with government regulation. It's got nothing to do with culture. It's got to do with individuals who have committed crimes that have caused all of our woes. Now, let me give you an example of what I think is coming. During the height of the crash, as the bricks were tumbling down all around us, you had the bank officers, bank president, brokerage house president. You had them in, talking to the press or around the clock virtually because the press was inquiring, oh, is your bank about to go? Are you illiquid? Do you have, you know, tarnished assets, blah, blah, blah? And these bank officers, these bank presidents were saying, well, no, as far as I can see right now, you know, we're liquid. We're going to make it through this. I think we're going to be okay. My prediction, and I'm happy to come back in a year, and you can either call me a prophet or you can call me an idiot. My prediction is there are going to be a lot of these prosecutions by bank officials, of bank officials, because they had the temerity to predict that their bank was going to make it okay, and the bank didn't make it through okay. And, of course, think about it. Think about a bank president being asked, is your bank liquid? And your depositors actually, if they wanted to withdraw their money tomorrow, would they get it? And what's he supposed to say? He says, no, there's an immediate rush on the bank. The bank is over in 10 minutes. So no officer of a bank can possibly get up there and say, we're gone, because then they are gone. And, of course, if you can maintain confidence, then the bank will make it through. And yet, watch these prosecutions. They're coming. How do I know this? Because it's already happened. Now, listen to this story. You know, everybody knows about Martha Stewart, right? She was indicted, not for insider trading, because what she did probably is not insider trading. Nobody can say for sure because the insider trading laws are so vague that nobody can define them. And they're, by the way, intentionally kept vague. Now, Martha Stewart had one count in her indictment that charged that when she was under investigation for insider trading or whatever they later, of course, got her to talk to the feds, and they indicted her for false statements in talking to the feds. There's a lesson in that. Don't ever talk to the feds. She was charged for having a press conference and releasing a statement saying that she was not guilty of insider trading. And so in addition to indicting her for false statements to the feds, they indicted her for falsely denying her guilt at a press conference of Martha Stewart living on the media. In other words, her crime was her failure to make an abject plea of guilty on national television in front of the entire press when asked about whether she had committed insider trading fraud. That's what tells me that these press conferences by these bank officials who were denying that they were on the edge of collapse they're going to get indicted for denying that they're on the edge of collapse, even though had they said otherwise, they would have collapsed. So it's really a kind of we're living in a world now which is a mixture of Orwell and Kafka, little bit of each. Now, people have said I didn't spend enough time in his book on solutions. I've got 6 or 7 pages on where I think we should be going, sort of general prescriptions of where we should be going. It's true that I don't have a lot of surefire solutions. That's not what the book is about. Besides, I'm not that smart. I'm a lawyer. I'm not an academic. And so I really don't know the solution. But I did want to point out the problem because I don't believe that our best minds are going to be able to be put to the task of solving this problem if we don't realize that it's a huge problem and that we're all so vulnerable. But I do have, at the very end of the book, I do have a few tentative suggestions for the directions in which we can be going. In any event, I do think that whatever the solution to this problem is, it's going to arise from an energized response by those people who love liberty and value liberty. They're going to come up with the solutions, whatever those solutions are. And Cato, of course, is part of that group, which is why I'm so pleased to be here today. I think this the coalition that Cato is building and participating in, which are bipartisan, left, right, and center, in the criminal justice arena, is very useful, and I think leads the way. So I think that we all have to work together on this, and perhaps we can just beat back the Leviathan. Thank you very much.
Mr. Silverglate, probably from the podium isn't the best speaker, but I highly recommend the book, and once you get a look at it, you'll see that he didn't mention how many laws there are. It is something like, I think when he wrote the book, like 3,400 federal laws, and now it's now up over 4,000. And these laws are, if you read about it, you can find various sources on the Internet, certainly in journal articles and libraries and things. They're purposely made vague so that they can be applied to anybody that they want to, I hate to use the simplistic term get, but anyone that they want to get, they're able to do it. So we need to do something about this. And he said that the people are coming together from both ends of the political spectrum. He would be a good example there standing at the Cato Institute. And they're just tired of this. And the Martha Stewart case is just incredibly interesting. If you haven't looked at it, everybody thinks she was convicted of insider stock trading. Not only was she not convicted of insider stock trading, she was never charged with it. She was charged with obstruction of justice and then making a false statement that he was talking about. So what causes this? And one of the things he sort of glossed over, but I think he knows from his work, is many of these prosecutors are exceedingly ambitious. And the idea of seeing their names in print and knocking down a few people, he has examples of that in the book, that prosecutors have just kind of run wild in terms of charging people with these fake statutes. So it's a very interesting book to pay attention to, and I would highly recommend it. It's it's not one night. I imagine that Blakely read that book in one evening. It's if you're thinking about it, it seems to me like it would take a little bit more time than that. But it's certainly a good book to read. Let's see what else we can do here. Just one second. We're about ready to sign off, and looks like we've had a locked-up computer system here. Unbelievable. Must be a job invasion. Anyway, if we don't get to hear Vera Lynn tonight, join us next week, and thank you for listening tonight.
Take care.